Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Lit Fest kicks off today with a couple of events, including one with my guest today. Poet Ron Silliman has written and edited over 30 books, and his poetry and criticism has been translated into 12 languages. Silliman is most associated with the West Coast literary movement known as language poetry that developed in the 1960s and 70s. In the American Tree, published in 1986, which he edited, remains the primary language poetry anthology. Over the years, Silliman has been writing on a life work poem he calls Ketchak, a Balinese word for monkey, and also the name of a ritual performance which the residents of the island perform for tourists. The work, which he considers a single poem, includes three sections which are already published: The Age of Huts, Genting, and The Alphabet. That latter section the poet worked on for 25 years. The final section, titled Universe, began in 2005 and continues to this day. Silliman was the 2006 Poet Laureate of the Blogosphere, a literary fellow of the National Endowment for the Arts, and he received the Levinson Prize from the Poetry Foundation in 2010. He'll be speaking with University of Tulsa English professor Grant Jenkins this evening at 5 at Living Arts of Tulsa in one of the first events of this weekend's Tulsa Lit Fest. Ron Silliman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Rich.
In addition to publishing collections of poetry fairly regularly, you've been working on something that you call four long life poems, collectively called Ketchak. I may be close.
You are saying it right.
Yeah, a Balinese phrase that actually means monkey. Is that right?
It is. It's the Balinese word for monkey. It is a song that is used in a ritual in Bali that brings together cumulative voices. It's often done by as many as 200 people at once. And it sounds absolutely magical. I use the Dutch spelling. There are other versions of it available. It also was founded by a couple of American anthropologists in the 1930s who took a number of different Balinese elements and put them together precisely so that the locals would have a means of putting on something that would cause tourists to spend some money. So it's actually an early instance of the American intervention on globalism, creating what is supposedly an authentic experience that is no more authentic than the Blue Man Group in Las Vegas is the American avant-garde.
And so why this term to describe these long poems, which are 15, 20, the alphabet was, I think, 25 years. The alphabet is one long poem. Is it one long poem or is it a long poem in sections?
They are all one long poem. I am much more interested in poetry than in poems, per se. And I have known this about myself since I was a teenager, and it took me about 10, 12 years from when I first started trying to write poetry to getting to the point where I actually began working on this. But I've always sort of known this about myself, that the well-wrought urn always seems to me a relatively minor vase. And I'm much more interested in an immersive experience.
When you started writing poetry, when you first started to say, I think this is my means of expression, did you try traditional routes of poetry, or were you always looking for a new form, as you have with language poetry?
I went through a fairly traditional background, and I was fortunate, I was going to say lucky, in that I was a relatively good minor bird when I was a teenager. So I found myself in publications like the Southern Review, Tri-Quarterly, the Chicago Review. Poetry Magazine accepted a work of mine by the time I was 21, before I'd really started college. I took a three-year gap year. I came from a family that never thought about sending kids to college, which may seem odd given that I grew up in Berkeley. But there was definitely a town-gown divide, and my family was clearly on the town side of that divide. But having grown up in Berkeley, there were a lot of resources available to me the minute I discovered poetry, which I did at the Albany Public Library in Albany, California.
Yeah. What were the things that excited you about poetry when you were first writing?
Well, it is to some degree the same things that excite me now. It is the art of language. It is the only literary form that allows you to do exactly what you want to do. So it can be as narrative as you like, as focused on sound as you like, as focused on the typographical elements as you like. You get to pretty much make all of the rules. And conventional poetry has some fairly traditional rules. Innovative poetry is no less rule-bound, but they're actually interested in identifying and creating new rules. I'll give you an example of how that's played out in my own lifetime with somebody from Kansas. A man by the name of Ronald Johnson took John Milton's Paradise Lost. He took a particular 19th century version of that work, and he began with a Sharpie crossing out words and lines until only 5 to 10 words per page remained. He then typed it up in that format, but without the dark black lines, and published it as a work called Radios. Radi comes from paradise, and O's is the middle of lost. That is a work that has been replicated by a lot of different poets over the course of the past 30 years. I recently was reading Yetta Morrison's Darkness, in which she takes Heart of Darkness by Joseph Conrad and eliminates every single reference to human beings from the work and gets a similar kind of text on the page to what Ronald Johnson had, although her forms, she's using whiteout and she's using photocopies of the original page. So she's giving you much more of the graphic element of it. But in fact, actually, it's a very interesting work. And if you look at Conrad's concept of nature, which is what's really coming through here, that's a dark, bleak world he lives in.
So it becomes just an interesting journey, but without the people populating it.
Yes, and she has written about all the questions she had on that. Should she maybe only leave out the white people? Because Africans have been written out of history so many times, et cetera. There's a lot to think about there. But that's a form that didn't exist when I started writing poetry. It wasn't until the 1970s that Ron Johnson came up with this. And at that point, he was living in San Francisco down the street from me. Yeah. But he later went back to Wichita, which is where I believe he's buried. Hmm. So,
now, you earlier mentioned, said you were immediately attracted by the sound of poetry. And I think of when you were first starting, were the beats a huge influence? Because that's all about the rhythm and repetition. And
when I was first starting, I was reading constantly in the newspapers that the Beats were the new, young, interesting poets in America. And Allen Ginsberg and those people were all exactly the same age as my parents. And one thing I knew was that if they were the same age as my parents, they couldn't be new. And it was very suspicious to think that they were young and exciting. But I got to be pretty good friends with a number of them, including Allen Ginsberg over the years.
So your particular poetry was perhaps a reaction against it?
Oh, well, only insofar as I felt the Beats were much too celebratory of an unreflexive concept of equating America with the heroic white male, which in the Vietnam War years looked very, very bad to a young person. And in retrospect, I think I probably was right. So I got much more interested in focusing on ways in which one could question the I in poetry rather than reinforce it.
So you became a big part of the movement, language poetry. What exactly is language poetry in your mind?
Well, there are multiple answers to that.
Yes, of course.
Language poetry was originally named by a critic by the name of Alan Soldofsky. who wanted to be able to say, language poetry is junk, you don't need to pay attention to it. And in that regard, it falls in with the Beats, or in painting with the Fauvist. All these movements over the years were in fact named by people who were attempting to make people forget them rather than remember them. But it became a catchy name, and it was close to some of what was visible to an outsider, in that people were doing things that explored how language functioned in ways that created new perceptions. An example of this, my very first section of this project, which itself is also called Ketchak, has a repeating sentence structure so that no narrative gets beyond a single sentence. So essentially, every single sentence is a narrative, and you really have to learn how to read it that way. Otherwise, it makes no sense. This got to be known as the new sentence. I even ended up writing a critical book with that title on it. Never have been reviewed by the New York Times, but they now have a feature in their weekly Sunday magazine, which they call New Sentences. So it is, the idea has gotten out, but, you know, sometimes in these indirect ways, which is often what happens with poetry.
Now, I've heard language poetry described, somebody in describing your poetry was like, reading your poetry was like riding a train and watching the scenery go by.
Well, I have done some things like that. One of the sections is called BART, which is the name of the rapid transit system in the Bay Area. And in 1976, on Labor Day, they were trying to encourage more use of the system, because when it got started, a lot of people felt it was relatively limited in function. And so it was being underused in those days. So for a quarter, you could ride anywhere for the whole day. So I took the ride on the entire system, which in those days was just two lines, north, south, east, west. And during that, I wrote everything that I saw and thought during that ride, all as a single sentence. And that work has been republished. It's even was published as a book recently in Spanish translation in Chile. And why people in Chile want to know what it was like to ride the Bay Area commuter system in 1976 is a little hard for me to know, but they seem to think enough of it to go forward and do that.
Now, when you write a poem like that, you're obviously stream of consciousness while you're writing it, but is there a process after you finish riding the train?
And I do, and this is part of the heritage, actually, of the Beats. I do very little in the way of revision. I spend a lot of time thinking in advance and getting started on a work, and almost no time doing the revision, unless it's a specific project where I say this makes sense to do revision here, and then I build it into the process. But on a work like that, the notebook that was in my hand when I got off the train basically 5 hours later, with my hand quite cramped up from writing, was pretty much exactly what you see in print.
I was reading a more recent poem, I believe, that detailed a trip to the UK. Mm-hmm. And again, it's some of the elements you talked about where it was a single sentence, mm-hmm. maybe it would run for two or three lines, mm-hmm. but it would be a single sentence, and then it would be something different. And it was almost the way we do an internet search now, where you start on one subject and 30 minutes later, you've gone down a rabbit hole that leads to another rabbit hole and another rabbit hole. Just the way our mind processes the world, in which you can concentrate for a moment, and then out of the corner of your eye, you'll see something else, and you'll focus momentarily on that, and then your concentration's destroyed. It's almost like you're writing that sort of an experience.
When I got interested in meditation about 15 years ago, one of the concepts that I learned from, I use a relatively traditional Soto Zen version of meditation, that I got from my teachers was that you are not your thoughts. And to a writer, that's a very unusual concept. But it's really true. If you try meditating and try just focusing on your breath for 15 minutes or so, one of the exercises that they use with beginning meditators is to just notice how many ideas will pop up spontaneously. And the idea in meditation is to recognize that and set them aside, go back to concentrating on the breath or the feelings in your feet or whatever you want to focus on. And it's a very interesting process to realize exactly how much of that is just going on all the time. The brain is a marvelously complicated entity, and it's always busy. I mean, certainly I have an active dream life, and it's interesting to watch it go by, just as if one were on a bus or a train looking out the window.
Yeah, I think I've heard it that often described as the monkey mind.
Yes.
Yeah, and I'm afraid I have an endlessly monkey mind. My guest today is Ron Silliman, a language poet. He's the author of over 30 collections of poetry, teaches at the University of Pennsylvania today. But the main life work is this poem titled Ketchak. And one of the sections, which is a section of poetry, which at one point thought it was one long poem, is the book The Alphabet, which you spent 25 years working on.
Yes. And it's the third stage in this project. I actually visualize these in my head as being like creating little Russian nested dolls, and I'm working out to the larger outer areas as I go. And I was in the second stage at the time, a work called Chanting. That's with a TJ. It's a writing implement. It's the instrument you use to write in batik, for example, mm-hmm. on dresses. Also an Indonesian process, and also the Dutch spelling. But people hear chanting, and they think you're talking about a form of singing. And it's precisely that oral confusion that I'm trying to point to there. But as I was coming to the end of that particular work, and that took a couple of years, I began to realize that this next section was going to be a different project, and I had some ideas on what some of the sections were going to be. And oddly enough, I didn't begin at A, because I sort of knew what A was going to be. And when I got inspired to actually start writing, I knew I was writing the F section, because I had sort of laid out that plot knew where it fit. So I didn't necessarily begin or proceed in an orderly fashion. But I did get through all 26 sections. Was really glad I was not writing in a language that had 74 letters, and sometimes wished I'd been writing in Hawaiian, which only has 7.
Now, I can hear people saying, how do you spend 25 years writing one poem?
Well, it's always the blank page in front of you right now. It's pretty simple in those terms. When I was a boy, and I mean literally like 13, 14, 15, I knew from the age of 10 I was a writer, but I didn't really understand writing or genres or things to that effect. And I wrote the worst little boy novels ever written. And at a certain point, I was reading, trying to understand poetry, because I knew it existed and I hadn't connected with it, and I had tried on multiple occasions. And I picked up The Desert Music by William Carlos Williams. Most narrative thing he ever wrote. And what I saw in it was exactly the opposite. I saw the freedom from narrative he was taking in his use with lines and line breaks. It's odd to look at it now, because it's all about crossing the border back and forth in El Paso. It seems very much in the news these days. But when he was doing it in 1953 or whenever it was, there was virtually no border gate whatsoever. And he focuses on a peasant who is sleeping on the bridge halfway between the two countries, and spends a lot of his time sort of riffing on you know, what that means, this person between two places, between an old traditional way of life and the modern world, which El Paso represents as distinct from Juarez. And it's a fabulous poem, but clearly is the most narrative thing he ever wrote in poetry. I mean, he wrote some novels and short stories. But what I saw in it was exactly the freedom from doing that. And he talks at the very end about being proud and ashamed to be a poet. And I thought that combination of proud and ashamed just captured exactly what I was sort of trying to get to in my own work, a place where I could be completely vulnerable and yet aggressively myself.
Well, would you be willing to read for us?
I would be happy to do so. Actually, I'm going to read a little bit from a section that I'm working on now. It's not complete and probably won't be complete for a couple of years. Not an unusual thing for me. And it's called American Songbook. And it is a work of relatively short contained poems, which is why I thought to include it. And the first one, J is for Juvenile, is a work I wrote. I was asked by a museum in Philadelphia if I would write a work only referring to elements saved from the childhood collection of toys of Marianne Moore, which the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia happens to have. They actually acquired her living room in Brooklyn, which they have completely recreated upstairs in one of their rooms. The only thing I think a reader might want to know is that the word battledore at the very end of the poem is, in fact, an implement used in the game of badminton. And it's called J is for Juvenile, because this is the part of her life that she was in. And now it's going to sound just the opposite of American avant-garde poetry. This April eve you do deceive with the sign of youth as an open mouth, or a book laid wide and a wish supplied, anonymous as a stare that cried, I was there, with my silver boat and a mouth, my moat, so never mourned the boy his horn, one stroke to score his battledore.
Yes, that is not what I would associate as a Rod Silliman poem.
except
the imagery moves from place to place.
It moves from place to place. There are multiple games going on in there. One of the rhyme schemes is intended to bring to mind the work of Maurice Sendak, who was the best friend of the two men who ran. They were a pair of brothers who were rare book dealers and had side-by-side townhouses that they turned into a single property, which is what this museum is. And they have most of Maurice Sendak's works, along with, you know, a typescript of James Joyce's Ulysses and other such wonderful things.
I see you have another poem in front of you.
I actually have five poems I did not write. That's its title. And I'm just going to read the first three. 20th century. Petals on a wet black bough beside the white chickens. 20th century. Petals on a wet black bough, so sweet and so cold. 20th century. Petals on a wet black bough, starving, hysterical, naked. And that work, every one of those lines comes from a famous American poem of the 20th century. The first line in each case from Ezra Pound's Station at the Metro, and the last lines for the first two from William Carlos Williams' two poems from Spring and All, and the third one from Allen Ginsberg's Howl. So there's the Beat influence coming back once again.
Yeah. And that's sort of back to that experiment you were talking about earlier, where you redact lines from other poetry, except there you're just cutting and pasting. But I don't want to say it's as simple as cutting and pasting.
It is as simple as cutting and pasting. I live in Philadelphia, and Duchamp's Urinal is an icon of artwork in Philadelphia. They have a wonderful Duchamp collection there at the museum, which refuses to allow the Rocky statue to actually stand on its ground, so it's 3 feet off the museum for the tourists. But, you know, that particular work of art is simply a question of taking something we recognize in everyday life and putting it into a different context. And that is precisely what causes people to stop and see it and have a reaction to it. I remember years ago when my sons, who are grown men now, were little boys. We were actually at that same museum looking at some contemporary artwork, and one of my sons, who's now a professor at Duke, wanted to know about this work by a fellow who was then having sort of a moment of notoriety by the name of Chris Afali. It was a fairly traditional canvas, you know, your basic rectangle with paint on it, but it was resting on two giant brown balls of something. And my son wanted to know what those were. And I explained to them that those were the leavings of elephants. And he must have jumped back about 10 feet when I said that, because that was not what he was expecting to see in the museum.
But again, it gets to the point of what you've been doing, which is really your poetry is really in the eye of the person that reads it.
And it very much is. And there are things I can see which would to somebody who knows them seem very banal, and to somebody who doesn't know them might seem much more interesting, might be the right way to put it. This morning I was writing about the fact that here I am in Tulsa. Tulsa is famous among poets in the United States as being the center of the second generation of the New York School of Poets.
Ron Padgett.
And I was thinking to myself, I remember once in Berkeley seeing a fabulous retrospective of the artwork of Joe Brainard, who in addition to being an artist was also a poet, wrote a very famous work called I Remember. And in Berkeley in the museum, there was a fabulous altar that he had created using almost entirely Prel shampoo bottles, really focusing on that particular sheen you get of the liquid inside the green bottle as light comes through it. And it's a gorgeous work. It's actually not a typical work of his, although he went through a period where he seemed to be either he got a great deal on a lot of Prel bottles or was very attracted to that as a material. And there were some of those things. And I was thinking to myself yesterday, as I was walking around the memorial to Greenwood, you know, where in Tulsa do I find the monument to Joe Brainard? There should be one. I mean, he is somebody who people all over America know and love. And when they see his work, when they read his work, they think of Tulsa.
Yeah. I know Ron Padgett shares your sentiment on
yes.
that. Well, Ron, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Richard.
Pioneering language poet Ron Silliman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be one of the first events of this year's 2019 Tulsa Lit Fest going on today through Sunday at various venues around the city. He'll be speaking with Grant Jenkins tonight at 5 at Living Arts of Tulsa. For more information on Lit Fest, visit tulsalitfest.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.